Mr. Speaker, before I come to the wider aspects of this debate, let us recall one thing. The background is the future of Westland and its workforce. And we have to remember that future still hangs in the balance. The government's position throughout has been that it is for the company itself to take decisions about the course to follow in the interests of the shareholders and the employees. But the government is a major customer of the company, and the government's policies and intentions in that capacity are very relevant to the decisions which the company has to take. It is therefore of the first importance that any pronouncements by the government that might affect the company's decisions are accurate, consistent, and in no way misleading. And it is largely because one member of the Cabinet could not accept arrangements designed to secure the accuracy and consistency of government statements that we are debating the whole matter today. Mr. Speaker, I propose to deal at once with some questions which have arisen since my statement of the 23rd of January. And I shall do so under three headings. First, the circumstances leading up to my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General's letter of the 6th of January. Second, the reasons for having an inquiry. And third, the outcome of the inquiry. First then, Mr. Speaker, the circumstances leading up to the Solicitor General's letter. The House will recall that I had cleared my own letter of Wednesday, the 1st of January, to Sir John Cuckney with the departments concerned and with my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General, for the reasons I have already given. On Friday, the 3rd of January, there was an exchange of letters between Mr. Horn of Lloyds Merchant Bank, representing the European Consortium, and my right honourable friend, the then Secretary of State for Defence. In his letter, Mr. Horn asked for amplification of a statement in my letter to Sir John Cuckney. As the House knows, my right honourable friend went into considerable detail in his reply. His letter had not been discussed with my office before it was sent, even though it dealt with points arising from my letter to Sir John Cuckney. On the following day, Saturday the 4th of January, I saw copies of the exchange of letters. In view of the very careful steps which I had taken to clear my letter to Sir John Cuckney with the departments concerned and with the Solicitor General, I made inquiries to find out whether the Defence Secretary's letter had been cleared in the same way with the Department of Trade and Industry and with the law officers. It had not. In view of the continuing need for accuracy and consistency in government statements on this subject, I asked that a message be sent to my right honourable and learned friend, the then Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, as the sponsoring minister for Westland, to suggest that he should ask the Solicitor General to consider...
Order! Order!
To consider the Defence Secretary's letter and give his opinion on whether it was accurate and consistent with my own letter to Sir John Cuckney. The Solicitor General, on the basis of the evidence available to him, formed the provisional opinion that the Defence Secretary's letter contained material inaccuracies which needed to be corrected. This view was reported to me. The matter could clearly not be left there. I therefore, through my office, asked him to consider writing to the Defence Secretary to draw that opinion to his attention. I learned subsequently from the Solicitor General that he spoke to the then Defence Secretary on the telephone that same evening and told him his provisional opinion about the letter, warned him that he would probably write to him on Monday the 6th of January when he had checked the documents and advised him to correct the inaccuracy. The Solicitor General further considered the documents on the morning of Monday, the 6th of January. They confirmed him in his opinion. He therefore wrote to the Defence Secretary, advising him to write again to Mr. Horne, correcting the inaccuracies. My right honourable friend, the member for Henley, has asked for the further exchanges between himself and the law officers to be published, and I have arranged for copies of the correspondence to be placed in the library of the House. It has been said that the letter to Mr. Horne has not been corrected. So far as the government are concerned, we made clear to the company in the letter to Sir John Cuckney of the 13th of January from the Permanent Secretary at the Ministry of Defence, a copy of which has also been placed in the library of the House, that there was nothing to add to my letter to the company of the 1st of January. Perhaps more to the point, my honourable friend, the Minister of State for Defence Procurement, made clear in his answer to the honourable member for Yeovil on the 13th of January that the order for 6 additional Sea Kings would be placed if the plans for the five-nation battlefield helicopter project were approved, whichever reconstruction proposal Western shareholders approved, and not, as my right honourable friend had indicated, only if the European consortium proposals were accepted. I explained to the House on the 23rd of January how extracts from the Solicitor General's letter were disclosed to the media on the 6th of January. I repeat that I deeply regret that this was done without reference to him, the Solicitor General. Indeed, with hindsight, it is clear that this was one, and doubtless there were others, of a number of matters which could have been handled better, and that too I regret. As I said to the House on the 23rd of January, the company were also informed. There have been reports in the newspapers to the effect that that statement was wrong and that the company had not been informed. I understand that Sir John Cuckney's office have now confirmed that he did receive a call from the Department of Trade and Industry in the early part of that afternoon. The official in the Department of Trade and Industry concerned has again clearly confirmed that he made such a call, as he told the head of the civil service in his evidence to the inquiry. As the full details of the disclosure only became known as a result of the inquiry, which was subsequently instituted, I propose to deal next with the question as to why it was decided to hold such an inquiry. I will deal these things under the three headings I have indicated. On Tuesday, the 7th of January,
The Prime Minister's not giving way.
On Tuesday, the 7th of January, the day after the Solicitor General's letter was disclosed, my right honourable and learned friend, the Attorney General, sought the view of the head of the civil service as to whether it would be appropriate for the law officers to seek a formal inquiry. That was Tuesday, the 7th of January. After discussions between the Attorney General and the head of the civil service, my right honourable and learned friend made clear his view that there should be an inquiry. The head of the civil service minuted me formally on Friday, the 10th of January, seeking my authority for the institution of such an inquiry, and I readily gave him that authority. In fairness to everyone, it was essential to have a full and objective report on what had happened. And it was clearly desirable that all the officials concerned should be able to give their own full accounts of their part in what had occurred. My authority was conveyed to the head of the civil service on Monday, the 13th of January. The following day, I informed the House that an inquiry had been instituted. I had been asked by the law officers to institute one. I was formally advised by the head of the civil service to do so. I had no doubt that it was right to set up the inquiry. Indeed, Indeed. On the 7th of January, the Honourable Member for Swansea West, an opposition front bench spokesman, wrote to me to ask that an inquiry should be set up so that, I quote, the full facts can be established. Even so, some honourable members opposite have subsequently criticised the decision to hold an inquiry. If I had, of course.
Alan Williams.
She indicated she had this letter from me the day following the actual leak. Why on earth hasn't she indicated to the House whether she actually knew the facts of a leak at the time she received that letter?
I am dealing with the setting up of the outcome of the inquiry and what I did know and what I did not. I have in fact done this what I believe is the best order, and I must ask the honourable member to be patient. If I had rejected the advice I had received, if I had refused to hold a formal inquiry, the parties opposite would have had just cause to criticise me, and I have no doubt that they would have done so. To be criticised when I agreed to an opposition request to hold an inquiry is, to say the least, an unusual experience. The inquiry reported to me on the 22nd of January. In my statement to the House the following day, I set out the steps by which the Solicitor General's letter of the 6th of January was made public, as this emerged both from the accounts of officials as reported by the inquiry and also from my subsequent discussions with the then Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, whom I should like in this House to thank for his years of devoted service. I'm going on because I have a long speech to make and I must get through it. It was the common purpose of all concerned that at a time when difficult commercial judgments and decisions had to be made by the company, it was important that all pronouncements by the government should be accurate, in no way misleading, and consistent with each other. It followed...
Order!
It followed from that if a statement was made which appeared to be inaccurate or misleading or inconsistent with other government statements, then it was the duty of the government to make sure that the record was corrected as soon as possible. When the Solicitor General's letter was brought to his attention, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry took very much that view of the matter. He was clear that it was desirable to bring into the public domain as soon as possible the fact that the Solicitor General had written to the then Defence Secretary and the opinion he had expressed. The Secretary of State made it clear to his officials that, subject to the agreement of my office, he was giving authority for the disclosure to be made by his department if it was not made as he said he would prefer from number 10 Downing Street. This I indicated in my statement last week. Officials, this is a very tightly drafted argument, and I would prefer to go on, but then I will give way later. Officials in the Department of Trade and Industry.
Order. I think the Prime Minister said she would give way later. Prime Minister.
Officials in the Department of Trade and Industry, I will give way to the Honourable Gentleman later. I wish to continue this section. Officials in the Department of Trade and Industry approached officials in my office who made it clear that it was not intended to disclose the Solicitor General's letter from number 10 Downing Street, but being told that the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry had authorised the disclosure, they accepted that the Department of Trade and Industry should make it, and they accepted the means by which it was proposed that the disclosure should be made. My officials made clear to the inquiry that they did not seek my agreement. They told the inquiry that they did not believe that they were being asked to give my authority, and they did not do so. If they had believed...
Order!
...is being sought, they would certainly have consulted me. Officials in the... not at the moment. This is very important. Officials... officials of the Department of Trade and Industry told the inquiry that they regarded the purpose of their approach to my officials as being to seek agreement to the disclosure as well as to the method. They believed that they had the agreement of my office and acted in good faith in the knowledge that they had the had authority from their Secretary of State and cover from my office. Though I must go on at this moment, please, may I, this is vitally important. Though clearly neither side realised it at the time, there was a genuine difference in understanding between... there was a genuine difference in understanding between officials as to exactly what was being sought and what was being given. Of what officials on each side told the inquiry. That is one reason why it was vital to set up the inquiry. Officials told that right. As I indicated, officials too had the right to put their view of their part had what occurred, and I resent deeply
Order.
Upon them.
Order. No. Order. No. The Honourable Member knows the Prime Minister said she would give way later. He mustn't keep on rising.
But it is common ground that, as I told the House on the 23rd of January, it was accepted that the Department of Trade and Industry should disclose the fact that the then Defence Secretary's letter of the 3rd of January was thought by the Solicitor General to contain material inaccuracies which needed to be corrected, and that in view of the urgency of the matter, the disclosure should be made in the way it was. I have given the House this account of the accounts which were given to the inquiry. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman, if the Right Honourable Gentleman, who has been rising and to whom I promise to give way.
Sir, to the friendly intervention of her honourable friend, the member for Woking, in relation to putting it into the public domain. Here in the Hansard it says of the Prime Minister, I gave my consent. Now, what are we to derive from her own words in answer to her honourable friend, the chairman of the 1922 committee, column 455, I gave my consent. What interpretation should we put on that?
I gave my consent to an inquiry. I cooperated with it. I cooperated with it. And I set out fully as I possibly could in that statement. I noticed that I had said that at the particular time. I did not give my assent to the disclosure. It was not sought. And I have indicated that I deeply regret the manner in which it was made.
I'm grateful to the Prime Minister. Could she tell us what conceivable misunderstanding between the Department of Trade and Industry and her office could permit them to breach the Official Secrets Act, and to, in the words of the Solicitor General, immediately and flagrantly violate an important rule without any form of consultation with her as head of government? Will she now tell us when she knew?
But, Mr. Speaker, I have just, in fact, set out precisely... Yes, Mr. Speaker, I have just, in fact...
Order!
I have just, in fact, set out what my officials believed and what the Secretary of and what the Department of Trade and Industry officials believed. The Right Honourable Gentleman will not accept that there was a genuine difference of understanding, which is something that happens almost every day in normal life, and he tries to deny it. Officials, too, have their right to be heard and not automatically to be castigated by the other side when they have no right to be replied. Now, I come to the part which I think honourable members will be asking. I did not myself know about the disclosure of the Solicitor General's letter until some hours after it had occurred.
Order.
Honourable Right Honourable Gentlemen have been asking me for the facts, and I am giving them. And I have taken immense trouble to have them checked. I discussed the matter with my office the following day when I also learned of the law officer's concern. I was told that the Solicitor General's advice had not been disclosed by my office. I was also told in general terms that there had been contacts between my office and the Department of Trade and Industry. I did not know about the then Secretary of State for Trade and Industry's own role in the matter of the disclosure until the inquiry had reported. The difference...
Order! 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 The Prime Minister's not giving way, I think. The Prime Minister...
The difference of understanding... May I complete this section? Then I will. The difference of understanding between officials in my office and those in the Department of Trade and Industry only emerged after the inquiry had started. I give way to the Right Honourable Gentleman.
Is the Prime Minister telling us that right from the day after the leak on the 6th or the 7th, right up until after the inquiry had reported, her Right Honourable friend, the Secretary of State for the Department of Industry, didn't make any effort whatsoever to tell her how he had authorised the inquiry, and if so, does he authorise the leak? If so, does she think that such a member is fit to be a member of any cabinet, let alone hers?
Mr. Speaker, I have indicated what the facts are, and I have indicated the high regard in which I hold my Right Honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Industry. Mr. I have given the answers after strenuous efforts to check them with officials concerned and with the departments concerned. Mr. Speaker, the government's policy throughout has been to help Westland seek the solution which would enable the company to continue in business as a private sector concern. It is this government which fought to help them to get the Indian order. It is this government which undertook to write off nearly 40 million of lawn shade if the W30 project was terminated. It is this government which ensured that the board of Westland had a choice of options. And it is this government which has pledged itself to resist discrimination against Westland in Europe, whichever option for its future it chooses. This was and is the right policy. But from the opposition, we've heard nothing constructive. Oh, yes, in the debate on the 15th of January, they offered the company their own two options. But what were they? Nationalisation or receivership? The fact is that the opposition parties, with the exceptions of the honourable members for Yeovil and the Isle of Wight, are exploiting Westland and its employees, exploiting them for nothing more than their own narrow political advantage. It was the right honourable gentleman, the leader of the Labour Party, who told his party conference, and I quote, "You cannot play politics with people's jobs. They have no time for such posturing." Yet that is precisely what he has been doing and has done again today. Mr. Speaker, let me tell the real reason for this debate. It is not because of the opposition concern for Westland and its employees. Until today, they've said precious little about them. It is not because of their passionate belief in the defence of the realm, their policies for name and defence.
I remind the Right Honourable Lady of the real reason, as she put it, for this debate. It is to find out the truth. The House is not satisfied, the country will be not satisfied that she has given us the full details. I ask her again, when truly did she know, and can she expect us to believe that her office didn't tell her when they knew, and can she expect us to believe that she was neither told by the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, nor did she ask the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry exactly what was going on.
What the Right Honourable Gentleman can't stand is that I've given him the facts and that they have been checked. I have given him the facts. He doesn't like them. Mr. Speaker, the party opposite have deliberately blown up this issue out of all proportion. This debate is part of a massive diversionary tactic by the opposition. They would like first to divert public attention from the growing extremism of their own party. And we have all seen, as we have all seen so unmistakably in Liverpool, Lambeth and Tottenham. And second, it is a tactic to divert us from vigorously pursuing our policies and plans for our country's future. We are not going to be diverted from the task we are elected to carry out.
Order.
We shall gather with renewed strength to extend freedom and ownership, to give power back to the people, and to keep our country strong and secure.